Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another edition of On Mic with Jordan Rich, conversation alive and well with creative people who have a lot to say and a lot to offer. Today, first-time novelist J.B. Harris joins us, and her book is terrific. It's called The Immigrant's Wife, historical women's fiction inspired by the disappearance of her own great-grandfather in the 19-teens. It's not only an epic love story, at times very tragic, at times exceedingly happy, but it's a remarkable historical look of what the immigrant life was like in the early part of the 20th century. It was a hard, challenging life that, in reading this wonderful book, one comes to appreciate. Let's now meet the lady who put The Immigrant's Wife together as we welcome J.B. Harris, and she's joining us now on mic. We're going to be talking about The Immigrant's Wife, the story behind the story, but I'd love to get to know a guest right up front. J.B. Harris, love your work. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And you're from the Bay State, which is where we are bringing this podcast to life every week.
Yes, born and raised in Newton, and then now I'm in Hingham.
You told me right before coming on air that you attended Emerson College.
I did, for writing.
So, for writing, but yes. You all, almost through osmosis, you get to know how to handle a microphone.
A little bit, yes. Everyone in radio wants a Saturday night off, and then they ask you to come cover their show for you.
There you go. You get the picture. So, short fiction prior, this is the first novel, and this novel has a lot of autobiographical elements to it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Your background, tell us about it.
All right. Well, my writing background is, as I said, I went to Emerson, have my MFA. I've been writing my whole life. And my heritage background is really where this book starts. I grew up believing that I was Irish, English, and Scottish. And then one day when my grandmother was in assisted living, she said that she remembered a man watching her on the swing set. And she always wondered if that was her father. And I thought, wait, don't you know whether that was your father or not? Mm. But things weren't talked about back then. So that was the first time I learned that the man I thought was my great-grandfather was not my great-grandfather.
So let me just put this in chronological or contextual context, if that is a word. The setting of the book, which is the 19-teens or so, is the same setting as your great-grandfather?
Correct.
Okay, just want to put things into place for myself. And what background was your great-grandfather?
Well, it turns out he was Greek. Nobody talked about him, so her name had been changed to Patrons, and that's what I thought it was. And then when I was doing the research for her to try to find out more about her father, I learned that her name was – her birth certificate actually reads Patrinos with an I. And found out he was Greek.
Well, I didn't know that till I get to the end and I read the afterword. And I was kind of happy I didn't know that because it was more fun to figure out, you know, after the fact, this is a very close connected story to the author. You said it in Boston. Was that also where it was happening in real life?
Yes, probably more Lowell than downtown Boston. Mm-hmm. He came in and was in Lowell. But when I did the research, I found them listed in Dorchester. And my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather, and my grandmother. So they were married, and they all did live together for 2 years.
Now, have you, since this self-discovery and you wrote this beautiful book, have you had a chance to go to your home country, so to speak, or one of your home countries?
Yes, I actually went to Greece before the book was finished.
Ah.
I started doing the research. Kind of got stuck here in America, wanted to learn more, went over there. I got very close. I did not get to the village he was from, but I got to a village called Patras, which is where he would have gotten the name Patrinos.
My wife just returned with her sister and our niece from Greece. Greatest experience ever. The most beautiful. She went to the islands, and they're just amazing. I just had to say that.
Oh, it is gorgeous, and the food is delicious.
The food is delicious. So The Immigrant's Wife takes place in early 1900s, and it's a love story, but every love story has to have conflict or it isn't really interesting. And there is conflict right off the bat when this heroine of the book falls in love with a young Greek gentleman. and he's not exactly welcomed in her home, is he?
No, not at all. He wouldn't have been, and neither would anybody else at that point, if you were not, you know, a white from England or Scotland or Ireland, and probably not even Ireland, man, you would not be dating a white woman. So back then, it was not a good thing.
It's so interesting. Back then, people thought of people of Greek origin as not white. It's crazy to think about color schemes and all that, but that's the tone. Even the Italians were considered non-Caucasians by the upper crust Caucasians.
Correct. When I was looking up the information on the different websites, and actually when I first started, there was no internet, so I had to go down into downtown Boston and look things up, and he was listed as black, as a Greek.
He was listed as black?
He was listed as black.
Okay. And what kind of occupations did most of the immigrants have in Boston at that time? I know he was involved in the fruit and vegetable area, right?
Yes. Produce. They would have had any of the grunt work they could get.
Yeah.
You know, the signs, Irish need not apply. Before that, they had the Greeks, the Italians, everybody. They were doing hard labor, long hours.
Let me say this. The Immigrant's Wife book that we're talking about by J.B. Harris, it's a novel based on her past, her own history that you are bringing us to this place like no other author could, in my estimation. I believed every square inch of what I was reading. I felt cold. I felt hungry. I was right near my fridge when I was reading it, but that's a credit to you. But let's talk about the conditions back then before we get into the storyline too much. This was really rough for anybody, but particularly for those who came across the river or across the big pond.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a lot of research to kind of figure out what they would have had to live without, just from the time frame, and then what the poorer people would have had to live without and how they would have lived. And they would have been in tenement houses. Prior to being married, they would have been in boarding houses. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just many people in a small area. It's one of the reasons that they often would get ill, and they were often looked on as the unwashed and the unclean, because they were packed into small places and anything that could be transmitted was.
And this is prior, the book is set prior to the Spanish flu outbreak for much of it. So we'll talk about the disease of the day, which was pretty horrid, and how people were treated. Anna, let's examine your immigrant's wife. Let's examine her. She's a strong character, beset by a lot of issues, including her parents, who basically disown her, it seems.
Yes, they do.
Okay. What can you tell us about Anna for the listeners who want to read the book without giving up everything?
Well, I think in the beginning, she's a little naive. She has ideas of what the world should be like, and she's probably right. You know, she's interested in the suffrage movement. She believes that everybody should be treated equally, and that's what she wants. That's what she thinks her parents are like until she learns differently. She is, you know, hangs her hopes on the star of marrying the man that she loves and that will carry them through. And as a result, ends up living in the immigrant area of Boston and learns that, you know, the prejudice goes both ways.
It does, as we'll discuss. But her family, particularly her mother, is very, very harsh and not very understanding and not very lenient in this regard. And it really pained me to read that. But I know it's true. It still happens to this day in some cases in some families.
Absolutely. And in the novel, I don't know much of my own great-great-grandmother's history, but in the novel, she comes over from Scotland, and she's a mill girl. And that was a really tough life. A lot of people died in the mills. A lot of, you know, it was just a horrible place to be. And she did not want her daughters to end up like that. So some of her harshness is, you know, we've done this to get you where you are. You're in a place where you could marry well enough that you don't have to do any of those things. Why on earth would you go backwards?
Mm. Yeah, no, I could sense that as well. It's well done. But she's got a sister who's more of a wild card, I think. And this is an interesting era for women anywhere in America because it's pre-right to vote, right? The suffrage movement was ongoing. And the opportunity for work, I mean, it was menial work. It was sewing, maybe working at a bakery or working at a candy factory, as she ends up working.
Right, taking in laundry.
There were no executive, very few executive women in charge of anything.
I'd be surprised if there were any back then.
Now let's talk about Charles, her beau. He's the young man from Greece.
Yes, he's come over from Greece probably around the age of 16. And he has been in the country for a few years working his tail off, and he's a good guy, and she falls in love with him and wants to be with him.
Exactly. And one of the things that's obvious, and it's true, is the hard work of immigrants at that period of time. Certainly from Europe, from even Asia, if you consider the folks from China and so forth, they work like, I was going to say slaves, but dogs to get any kind of sustenance to keep their families alive.
They absolutely did. And oftentimes they were uneducated and that sort of thing. But they were also people who came over that were educated and could have done jobs above what they were allowed to do in the States. Mm. One of the things I like to highlight that was true was that my great-grandfather spoke many languages. And so in the book, I have a couple scenes where, you know, he kind of embarrasses a couple of people with his knowledge of language who are talking down to him because
right.
they don't understand what
right,
he's saying.
Right, right, right. Now, the action in the story has to do with what their life is like when they go off together. And they are very much alone because, as you said, it wasn't just her side of the family, but it was his side that
right.
found fault with her. Explain that.
Well, in the book, his side of the family is actually still in Greece. So there is no one on the Boston scene that could take her in and help her out. Where they live is in a tenement house with a bunch of other immigrants. And everybody speaks their own different language. And they bring, you know, they're all there as a family unit. So breaking in to a place was hard enough if you were one immigrant versus another, Italian versus Greek, but then to be a white person on their ground, they did not want you there. They did not want you marrying their men or their women. So
extremely territorial.
Lonely. Yes.
Extremely territorial and very challenging for your main character, Anna, to just survive. I mean, not to be able to borrow a cup of sugar from somebody without getting the door slammed in your face.
Yes, very difficult for her. And I think an eye-opening because she felt like the problem was that the middle-class white people were always looking down on the immigrants. And then she goes into a place where she thinks she's going to be welcomed because she's a person who isn't like that. She is welcoming. Mm-hmm. And then she finds out, no, the sins of my fathers, and so to speak, wash off on her, where people really just aren't welcoming to her at all.
I tease this. We'll talk about it now. The disease that affected so many people back then, they called it consumption, but it was tuberculosis, the, science-based name.
Yes.
And it was a horrid disease because there was no, penicillin at that point.
Correct.
So what happens in the book really did happen. People would be forced into quarantine. And how was that played out in the book? How did that happen?
So in the book, he is forced out into quarantine and chooses not to let his wife know for reasons that I'm not going to go into it in
That's
advance because
okay.
I think it's interesting. But he's living off in a quarantine and she thinks she's been deserted. So the two of them are struggling in their own ways for their own reasons without really knowing what's going on with the other.
That was really eye-opening. I did not know that it was that extensive. And you had this, I guess, in Lowell, Massachusetts?
Yes.
The quarantined area where he went?
Well, originally...
No, he went to the hospital first.
He starts in Lowell Hospital and
right.
then because of the desire to keep it sort of anonymous and the fact that he was Greek and told everyone he had no family around, they exported him out to New York.
That's right. That was in New York. And tell me about the research you did in that area because you really paint a picture of what this place was like.
Thank you. I did a bit of research. I did a lot of reading other people's books and looking online and that sort of thing because by the time I got to that point, we did have the internet and I could do my research and look at pictures and read articles. But I also went to a sanitarium in Massachusetts and they are a museum. And so I was able to walk around and see some of the machines that they would have been using, talk about the treatment that they would have been using. discuss how the doctors interacted with the patients and so forth and so on. So
they had to provide their own social activity. I mean, they had books and board games, but they didn't have much in the way of, shall we say, entertainment, just to take their minds off of the endless waiting to die in many cases. And most of them, many of them, did die.
Yes. Most people who were diagnosed with TB would have died. Maybe not right away. The typical middle class way of going about it would have been, you get TB, you get sent off to a really nice hospital. You're there for 6 months to a year till you can breathe a little bit better and you seem to be improving. They then send you home. And then it all starts over again. Mm. And so most people would die, second or third time in.
JB, there was a technique, a medical technique that was involved the main character. And I'd never heard of that technique. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I tried to look into some of the more obscure techniques that they did in the early 1900s. They collapsed lungs.
That's right. Yeah.
Radiated you. They tried all sorts of different things. And so, if I remember correctly, in this case, they were collapsing the lungs, trying to rest them, is what they would say.
Which is exceedingly painful.
Yes.
I mean, if anybody out there has ever had a collapsed lung, and I haven't, but I know people who have, oh my God, it's like hell on earth.
Right.
So that's the cure in some people's minds for the disease.
Exactly. And the way they would do it is they would collapse your lung, and then they would let it slowly inflate on its own. And then when it was inflated, about 3 weeks later, they'd collapse them again.
Mm, incredible. You know what else really is poignant is the impact on children back then. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be surviving birth, right, to begin with, to make it through a typical childhood with all the diseases and with very few preventive measures, penicillin and all that, your odds were 50-50 maybe in some cases if you were poor in an immigrant family.
Oh, absolutely. Because, again, they're living sort of on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And so if one person gets it, then the next person gets it. And when you're having, 10, 12 kids and they're sleeping, all in one bed, head to toe, toe to head, they're going to pass along what they get.
It's really incredible to think that we have, in a way, similar issues today with the immigration coming up from the South, because these people are forced into huge swaths together, whether they be in hotels in New York or immigration detention camps or just in the scattered winds. And, they don't know perhaps that they're carrying a disease and can infect their kids. And, well, they've got other problems too, coyotes and drugs and all kinds of things.
Yep.
But the treatment of Anna, there are a few people who treat her well.
Yes.
There is always a bright light of hope, I guess, right?
Yeah, there always is. And, her sister is very good to her. Unfortunately, again, you can find out later in the book that doesn't last for reasons beyond either of their control. Mm-hmm. She does have some friends in the building, but she makes some choices that jeopardize that as well.
I could actually, because I live in Boston, I could actually visit some of these streets and know exactly where you put them.
You could.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah, I know you did.
There are some that no longer exist.
But if you and again, we're very Boston-centric here on this podcast. Hello, world. But if you take a walk in the South End or the North End or East Boston or any of these neighborhoods, you'll see buildings that existed in the 1800s and early 1900s. And you just say to yourself, oh, my goodness, what happened back then? No air conditioning.
Oh, yeah.
Very heat stunk. I mean, there was nothing you could do. And running water was a gift if you were lucky enough to have that.
Yeah, but today, a day like today, 90-something degrees in downtown Boston would have been miserable for all involved.
As we record this, it's in the 90s in September. But back then you just had to deal with it. And people didn't know any better. That's what they had to deal with.
That's what they did. Yep.
And there was a distinct separation, as there is unfortunately everywhere, with the upper class, I mean the Beacon Hill types and the Charles Street types and the downtowners. They didn't mix with those other people, those riffraff.
Correct, correct. And it was eye-opening for Anna to move into a tenement and to not have, a washing machine, to not have access to the hot water.
Yeah.
She had running water, but they didn't have hot water back then, so you had to boil everything.
In fact, didn't she have a job in the book doing laundry, but doing it by hand with a almost like an Indian rock?
I mean, yep, she had one of those washing boards, and she laments having, you know, the not having what she had on in her old home when she's doing that and realizing how hard a life it is for people to do that.
Also, it's fascinating to think about people and how desperate they were to come to America back then and had to cross the ocean in horrific conditions in steerage and ships. And many people didn't quite make it because the conditions were so poor. But how long would it have taken somebody, do you think, to go back to Greece or come from Greece back then?
I did the research on that. I don't remember exactly, but I feel like it was about a month.
Yeah.
It would have been.
So think about that. You're living in in the hull of a ship with a lot of other people and very few showers and lots of bodily odors and other things to deal with, not to mention disease. It's remarkable that people did what they did.
Yes, and some of them did it more than once.
So what does this story do for you in terms of understanding your own ancestry and also appreciating the immigrant experience? Tell me in your own words.
Well, first, learning in my 20s that I was Greek was just shocking and interesting because, you know, being an English, Scottish, Irish woman is one thing, but having some of that Greek fiery blood explains a lot. I wish I had known when I was younger, when I could have learned how to cook the Greek cuisine and speak the Greek language.
Well, do you break dishes now on festive occasions?
I do not.
Oh, okay.
Maybe
well,
I should. I'll
maybe
use
you
that.
Should try to do
I
that.
Use
yeah.
that. I do drink my, ouzo every now and then. Yep.
It had to have really informed you about your life in a whole new way.
It really did. First of all, just fascinating that, you know, I remember asking my father when he was still with us, do you remember your grandfather? And not my great-grandfather, because he would have left, but the man that my great-grandmother ended up remarrying in real life. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what about your real grandfather? He said, oh, no, I never knew. I said, did you ask?
Yeah.
But people wouldn't talk about it back then. So learning all of this history was pretty interesting.
I think we're living in an interesting age where, you know, DNA testing and 23andMe allows us to do that. And I'm constantly saying, I'm going to do that. I haven't done it yet. I will do it. Your book might inspire me. But I think the suggestion that we don't know our great-grandfather, I don't know who my great-grandfather was. I have no idea. I mean, I know he came from Eastern Europe, but that's all I do know. But it's fascinating to explore and then maybe be surprised. You watch the Skip Gates show, the Henry Gates TV show on PBS, where he unveils celebrities and what their background is?
Oh, is that? Yes, I do. Yes.
That is so darn fascinating. And when you realize that some actor who thought he or she was of one stock ends up being related to a slave owner as opposed to a slave himself, it just blows your mind.
It is. It's very interesting to think about, you know, you have this whole history for yourself and then you learn more. And you realize that, you know, people in your family really had to struggle and they were not always accepted and things weren't always as you thought they were. And one of the things I liked best about the story, the real story, which made me write the book, was that not all men who desert their family are scoundrels.
Yes.
And I wanted to write a book that would give one idea of why someone might leave their family that isn't nefarious and I took off because I didn't feel like being a dad.
Well, that takes a lot of gumption to do that in this day and age when men particularly are on the firing line for a lot of things, and some of them very well deserved. But I appreciate that very much because what's that story by O. Henry? He buys her the hairbrush, she cuts her hair. You know that
yes,
story.
Yes, yeah.
That's what I felt this book did.
Oh, because, really? Thank you.
Because there's a turning point, or there's a point leading up to the turning point where I'm saying, no, don't think this way or don't act this way or no, don't turn left, go right. But that's what makes it interesting. And when there's a resolution, it's very, very satisfying.
Well, thank you.
But getting there was not easy.
No, I've been told by a lot of people who read it, they better have your tissues with you.
Yeah. And not to say that it's a book for just sensitive types. It's a book for anybody, I think. And one of the things I just thought of a suggestion for you, and I'll make an overture. I think this would be an addition or a lovely adjunct to the New England Historical Society, because it's all about there, you know, the ancestral experience and the immigration to Boston and so forth. I think there's a lot of value here. So.
That's a great idea. Thank you.
I'm full of great ideas. It's just what we need, another idea, man, right? What's the next goal for you? What do you want to go? What do you want to do from here?
Well, I have a second book in the works that is not related, but it also deals with some of the harder challenges of the American way in the early days. It's about an octogenarian who ends up with Alzheimer's. But because she was forcibly sterilized through eugenics in the 1940s, she has no family to help her. And it is the story of who comes in to help her, why, and how that works.
That sounds like another immigrant-related experience. This happened in Europe, right?
No, this was here in America.
Oh, it happened in America.
Right here in America.
And this is based on research you've done?
Yes.
Wow.
We were doing a lot of things that weren't so great in the 30s and 40s. And then when Hitler went off on his tangent of those things, we realized maybe they weren't so terrific and we stopped.
Well, one of the lessons that I think learned through history and through really nicely written novels like this is you realize people did a lot of stupid things back then. They do a lot of stupid things now, but we've come so far just in the humane way we generally treat people from other parts of the world. Back then, it was inhumane.
Yes, it was horrible. And there's a lot further to go, but we have come far in a lot of things. And it's also often based, what I've learned in all my research for different things that I'm working on, is there's a problem. People identify the problem and they try to fix it. And sometimes the fix isn't much better than the problem that they identified. Mm. So it just takes time to get through. You know, unfortunately, all of the challenges that occur in some of these situations to get to the one that works.
Sometimes the hardest decisions you make are the ones that impact people and they don't know why you made that decision.
Yes.
That's a lesson to take away. And it's provocative enough to keep people very anxious to read on and on and on. I want to thank you. What's your website?
jbharrisbooks.com.
I said hello to you. I said, hi, JB. I'm JR. And by
true.
My JR, and I know JB is a name that you're going with, right?
Yes.
Okay. I was JR before JR got shot in Dallas. Okay.
Really?
Just so you know. And I never called myself JR personally, but people, my business partner, people just call me that. I kind of like it. Do you like the JB?
I do like the JB. It's an honorarium to my dad. The B is my maiden name. It's Barry.
Okay.
So JB reminds me of my dad and honors him. So.
It's got a nice ring to it. And as an author, I think you need something that people will remember. JB Harris. Sounds like a banker in a 1942 Frank Capra film. But
it does. Maybe I should write something like that.
So nice to meet you. The Immigrant's Wife by JB Harris. She sent it to me. I read it. I loved it. Can't wait to share it with my wife. Really wish you the very, very best. You're a hard worker and a very fine researcher in it, and it pays off.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
Once again, jbharrisbooks.com, The Immigrant's Wife, a terrific read, and a very solid dose of history about the immigrant experience. Thank you to all who subscribe and download this podcast. To those of you who rate and review, I'm especially grateful. And you can find out more about all of this at my website, which is my name, jordanrich.com. Till next time, dear friends, remember to be well so you can do good. Take care.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.